understanding not only the fate of Neanderthals, but the origin of Neanderthals. So I think we're all very lucky. You're very lucky having him here. And my intention today, tonight, is to really, as a corresponding to this invitation, is to open a treasure trove for you. I think one of the most impressive treasures, trove for hominins, that we have in the world. And I will show you why. I think we have an amazing opportunity to really understand part of the origins of our beloved but dead species, a sister lineage, Homo neanderthalensis. And I would like to show you today. I hope they can fix the problem with the computer because they are really worthy to look at. They are very beautiful fossils and I think you're going to be enjoying it. I also make use of the opportunity since I have the time to invite all of you to really come to visit the Atapuerca sites, which is, as you will show you too, there is no excuse for you to not to come because specifically there is El Real Camino Francés, which is the Royal French Way that goes all the way to Santiago de Compostela, Saint-Jean-Jacques, that really stops there and leads you through Burgos to visit the sites. And I really hope you have the opportunity to go and visit the real Jeworli pieces I'm going to be showing you today are in permanent exhibition, gracias, at the Museum of Human Evolution in Burgos. So yes, I'm going to show you and open for you a treasure trove of hominin fossils that, like a real treasure trove, is not easy to find. It's not really on the surface. Yes, it is located in the historical city of Burgos, close to it, 16 kilometers away from it, in the Atapuerca sites. And as I was saying, there is no excuse for you not to come because you can really make the trip. There is a specific way from here to there that will lead you to my beautiful homeland, Santiago de Compostela, but has an oblige stop in Burgos where, by the price of one, you can get three world heritages. The Atapuerca sites, the Cathedral of Burgos, and the St. Jacques Way, El Camino de Santiago by itself. It's really worth it to visit because here we have a treasure that is hidden in the insides of the Atapuerca Hill, which is not very high hill as you see, but the beauty, as many times happens, not always, is also inside. Because although it is not a very high mountain, it is full of cavities that have been buried, the results and the remains of our past. So it is indeed about the Cima de los Huesos that I'm going to be talking to you today. A little, small cavity of not more than 8 by 4 square meters that you have to reach after really a long way crossing very narrow corridors, very ample and beautiful galleries that are going to end up about after 1 kilometer of walk through this cave system in the Cueva Mayor, Cueva del Silo cart system in Atapuerca, is going to end up in a very steep vertical conduit of 14 meters deep that will reach one of the most precious places for those who love to dig in the past. So this is the Cima de los Huesos, this very small, tiny place where, however, we have been opening treasures for the last years that have really helped us to really understand the origins of the Neanderthal species. So only in this small place, so small that, as you can see here, almost only one person can excavate at a time, and the rest are really coordinating, taking care and notice of every single location of each of the fossils we're going to be finding, have been found more than 6,500 human remains to date. This is a big number by itself, just as an absolute number, but it's also a big number because it represents more than the 80% of the hominin fossil record for the world for the Middle Pleistocene. And we are talking about a period that goes around 780,000 years to 120,000 years. So this is precisely the important period that is going to give us the clues to understand the origin of Neanderthals. We have recovered all the skeletal parts. So we have all the anatomical parts that compose of our bodies, and many of them repeated in several aspects. So it's going to give us the possibility also of studying variability. So thanks to that, we are able of having a very nice picture of a population that live in the Middle Pleistocene. We have recovered up to 28 individuals. 28 individuals that give us the possibility of something very unusual when we are dealing with hominin record in paleanthropology. Many times we are obliged to make inferences about how a population was, a population that lived in an area maybe of 1,000 square kilometers and even 100,000 years with only one individual or even not the whole individual but part of it, Sometimes we only found a whole mandible for hundreds of thousands of years, and we have to really like imagine how old that population living at that time in Europe was. In this case, we have a picture of a population. A population, and here we have the profile of death of these groups. That is surprising to see that we barely have only one individual that is below the age of 10, not many individuals that pass the age of 35, but most of the individuals we have are those in these early 20s and 30s. So it's surprising, because if it were to be a classic cemetery, what we would expect to find is a higher number of higher mortality, like hunter-gatherer populations, maybe, of the children that die at the beginning, in the early ages. And also, if it were like a cemetery, we'll be also finding more individuals that really reach the elderly. However, we are finding the young, the men, those that we expect that were in their flourishing age, supposedly those that should be the stronger and the healthiest. So something happened to this population. The thing is that we have been dating the Sima de los Huesos site by different methods. The latest radiometric study by Uranium Thorium Sirius knows that we are talking about a population that was buried in this site about 430,000 years ago. That makes the Sima de los Huesos sample the earliest hominin sample with clear Neanderthal features. And this is very important because we know that here, at least, starts the story of the Neanderthal lineage. Thanks to this amazing accumulation of fossils, we can really have a nice picture of how these hominins look like. As I was saying to you, we have an amazing representation of all the skeletal parts, and particularly to understand and to have an idea of how they look like in the external appearance, we have the long bones. Thanks to the long bones, we know that the hominins that live in the Sierra de Atapuerca around almost 500,000 years ago, they were relatively tall, wide, muscular individuals with very broad shoulders and thorax, very wide hips, that were slightly taller than the mean average that has been calculated for Neanderthals, but slightly shorter what we calculate that it would be the mean of early modern humans. However, if we compare this to the average of an actual population, Mediterranean population, we cannot consider that Sima de los Huesos or Neanderthals were short. But we have an idea of these hominins that are preceding the origin of the classic Neanderthals that were slightly taller, so it may be that the classic Neanderthal conformation, short and wide, with this very wide cylinder, may be indeed a specialization specifically of Neanderthals that was not that pronounced yet in the hominins from Sima. We have, thanks to the long bones, a very nice reconstruction of the external appearance, of the height, of their body weight, of their body mass. We also have this amazing, unique representation, the pelvis, which has been nicknamed Elvis because it really has made history too, like the singer, which is one of the most complete pelvis you're going to find in the Pleistocene record. It has been important because it has given us information not only about the external appearance of the hominins that live in the middle Pleistocene, but also has given us interesting information about delivery. How was the delivery of babies of these populations during the middle Pleistocene? In this case, we can see a comparison in the left pelvis from Sima de los Huesos, pelvis number one, and a modern human pelvis to the right. As you can see, there are clear, substantial differences in the width. We're really having very wide cylinders in the case of the pre-Neanderthal populations. And we also see they have quite similar, but quite ample, to obstetric canal. That means that probably because it has similar proportions, maybe slightly larger in the case of the pre-Neanderthal population compared to modern humans, that these populations were giving birth in a very similar way as actual populations. It's a little more ample, but it's also indeed a male, so we could even assume that for females could be this canal a bit wider. But basically, we have probably the same way of giving birth. We have, you know, our species, a rotational birth. That means that it's almost like a dance before being coming to life, that kids have to be rotating alternatively to make fit their widest diameter with the widest diameter of the pelvis. So probably also in the case of this hominins that lived 500,000 years ago, the liver was also a big and painful effort, and was also a species that, like us, was not born to be alone from the very beginning, because probably due to the difficult need of giving birth also in these groups, they were requiring the help of other individuals to give birth. So probably in our species and in all the sister species like Neanderthals, the thing of giving birth of coming to life becomes already a social event. But this pelvis has given us information not only about external appearance, not only about aspects related with the child coming to life, but also has given us information about pathologies. We have made a very detailed study of the pelvis and all the associated vertebra. This is one of the most complete lower backs we're going to have, which is quite exceptional because we are really talking about fossils of this antiquity. And we see that this individual has a lot of alterations of degenerative pathologies related in the articular surfaces of the vertebra and the sacrum. We have this alteration, this porotic surface, that means that they have been the bone remodelating. We have that this vertebra, as you see, has moved forward, slip over the articulation with the sacrum, it's a spondylolisthesis. We also have the Bastrop disease, which, as you see, the spinous processes of the vertebra are really like kissing each other. Indeed, it's called like the kissing spine disease. So it means that all the vertebras have been having degeneration, really bone formation in abnormal positions that is making this column very unstable. We are really having degenerative articular disease related probably with the age of the individual and quite a strenuous physical activity during his life. The estimation for the age for these individuals is about 45 years old. So we're going to have, in this case, one of the oldest individuals you're usually going to be finding in the middle Pleistocene. It is very interesting to think that at this time, having over 45 years old was to be an elderly in that population. Because of these pathologies, this individual probably have a lot of deformity in his spine, had difficulties in the mobility, in moving, and also had a lot of pain. So it also makes us wonder, how was life in the middle Pleistocene, and to what extent you could cope with it alone and without help, if you're really having problems to move and having all these difficulties related with agility and movement. But this type of articular degenerative disease, not only you have it in the case of the column and the pelvis, but we also have in other parts, but with a completely different distribution. And this is, for example, a case that probably you all know, which is the temporomandibular joint dysfunction. In this case, the articular degeneration is related to the condyle of the mandible that articulates with the base of the skull. And as you see here, it's going to enter in contact in an unusual way, in such a way that this friction is going to alter completely the articular surface, the part that enters in contact with the base of the skull. So we have this rough, porous surface, formation of bone and leaping around that is going to make that the contact is not anymore symmetrical, is not really fitting properly. So that is going to cause a lot of problems in the proper occlusion and closing of the mouth, apart from a lot of pain. So this is not, we say, a life-threatening pathology, but obviously it would be affecting the quality of life of these individuals. But what is very interesting is that it affects the 70% of the mandibles we have identified of the individuals from Cima de los Huesos, and that includes immature individuals. So in this case, it's not like we were seeing in the case of the pelvis and the column. It is not related with age. It's not only related with accumulation of degenerative problems along life and with the use you make. In this case, we are talking about to a somehow excessive load in this articulation, although some other authors have said that maybe the anatomy of Neanderthals and pre-Neanderthals in this aspect was less efficient than us, and maybe with the same forces they were really getting worn in an unusual way. But it is true that means that if even immature individuals, young guys were having this, means that in a way this articulation in the base of the skull was being subject of an unusual or at least not well compensated type of biomechanical forces. So we were also interested, for example, in trying to look this. Why do they have this? Is really they're using their mouths for something else? Is that they're really having a lot of extra biomechanical or traumatic habits for their mouths? The thing is that we also study what was then the rates of dental wear. We took the teeth of some immature individuals where the age of the assessment of the age is easier and that the crowns were not very worn, and we reconstruct the missing part of this crown. If we know the age of the individual and we know at which age the teeth enters in occlusion, we can calculate how long it took to wear all this part of the tooth. And we obtain these rates for the lower incisor. That means that it was about 0.3 millimeters per year. That if we make a calculation, means that these individuals, by the age of 40, would have their teeth almost completely worn. And here I bring you a very impressive case of one individual I will be introducing you shortly, when you see that the crown is almost completely worn. And it is done not only with such a lot of stress and wear, but at such a big rate that there is no time for the dentin to compensate and close the pulp cavity. And this is a big danger. You know, the pulp cavity is this cavity inside the tooth where the vessels and the nerves of the tooth are. Usually this has to be sealed, but in this case we have worn the tooth in such a rate, such a speed, that you see here was about to try to close this cavity, but didn't do so before the death of the individual. So this is really an open door for an infection. So something that can really start local in your mouth is really having open doors to the whole blood system. So a local infection can be easily become a general infection. And in these times, as we can imagine, with a really many sophisticated medical treatments, particularly we don't have the blissful antibiotics, we will be really having big problems, and something local may become a cause of death. And it keeps giving us a lot of information. We know more things about these populations. We know, for example, this type of very special wear facet that we are seeing here between the crown and the root at the neck of the tooth, at the cement enamel junction. And this very pronounced groove that you can even see here when we put the tooth in profile has been generated because of the repetitive introduction of a sharp, rigid or semi-rigid object to be used as a toothpick. But that means that has to be really done repeatedly for a long time to really leave in one of the hardest tissues of our body a mark like this. We also made a study of the marks inside with electronic microscope of this groove, and we also see these typical fine striations that are going to be found when it is because you have been introducing repeatedly an object. Probably they were using these because they were trying to remove some remains of the food that get allocated between teeth, because it was also very common in these populations that they have periodontal disease. So you have the receding bones, the receding gums, so it was easy that you have infections. So you really have all this cycle of having pain, wanting to alleviate the pain. So they were probably, and then a bit of habit, which is also a bit of it sometimes, and we know with some people in our days, to have the toothpick there and leaving these very impressive marks on their teeth. So in a way, they having their own way of hygiene, we could say. But then I think it's also very impressive from Cima de los Huesos that not only you find the big bones, as we were saying, the postcranial, this very nice pelvis, the most resistant fossil parts of our body, which are the teeth, because you know that the enamel is the hardest part, the hardest tissue of our body, so they are going to be always the most well-preserved remains in a fossil site. But we have also been able to recover the tiniest and smaller fossils that you can imagine. And I have to bring you this picture with a scale, but I have changed. So we keep going with teeth, and I will give you the mystery for the next. So the thing is that here what we're having is also another thing we have read in the teeth. The enamel of the teeth is a tissue that is going to be formed in layers. Each of these layers is like the rings of a tree. Each of these layers is a tree of red juice called, and it's going to have a reflection that you can really see in the surface of the tooth that is called perikimata. And we know that each of these bands takes from 8 to 11 days to be formed. So a very interesting approach also to the life ways of these hominins is the study of the enamel hypoplasia. Enamel hypoplasia refers to a defect you're going to have in this surface. And because we know at what time, at what age, the crown starts to form and at what age it finishes, and we can count the number of lines and we know how many days each of these lines takes to be formed, we can really calculate at which point whatever it was, the stress that caused the defect in the enamel happened. So these defects that you can see here as a band, as a defect in the normal formation of the tooth, refers to a type of specific stress. It's very difficult to really link these defects to a specific episode or something that you can say what was the thing that caused this. But generally, it's with stress, with malnutrition, with a serious disease, or something that has really interfered a process that was being biologically going in the right direction. So we have also made a study of the frequency of hypoplasias in these populations. Here you have also a very nice example. These are antimer teeth. So you know for teeth we have like a twin in the left and in the right. So this is also a very useful to really match teeth from the same individual. So we calculated that Encima de los Huesos populations from the 19 to the 30% of the individuals present enamel hypoplasias. This percentage is very similar, but it's slightly lower than the one that have Neanderthals. So my people say, okay, if it is a bit lower, it means that they have better health because they have less injurious episodes that really alter the formation of the enamel. But when we are paleoanthropologists, we are dealing with what we call the osteological paradox. Sometimes you don't have these marks of pathology because simply you have not survived to them. So sometimes having scars indeed and signs of disease in your bones at that time is a good signal because it means that you survived to them. And if you have a bone that you have really the remodelation means that it was healing, so mean that you survived to it. So in this case, we have very similar percentages in the case of Encima de los Huesos and Neanderthals. And it's also very interesting to see that there is a peak of frequency around the age of 3 and 4 years old. So some authors have proposed that maybe it could be related with weaning as a type of stress. Weaning, when you stop being fed with breastfeeding by your mother, it can be implied a quite of a big change for the individuals at that time because you are now dependent on a source of food that is not as stable a guarantee as it was when it depends on your mother, and because also implies some metabolic changes and adaptations in that time. This can be quite crucial and important, especially if we're talking about children that require such a high metabolic intake because their brains are growing at a very fast speed. So in that sense, in particular, Encima de los Huesos, we think this could be an indirect way of understanding that about 3 or 4 years old of age, kids were changing the type of alimentation. And here we go to the one I was telling you. From Encima de los Huesos, you have recovered the smallest bones you can imagine. The bones, as Jean-Jacques was showing you today, that has so much information, even these small bones, really have implications about taxonomy, but also about hearing capabilities. They are so small that, as you see, they are much smaller than a fly. And the preservation of the Encima de los Huesos allowed these things to happen. It is important not only because, okay, we say it's nice that every little part of our body has remained for the future and we can really study everything. It is important because these bones, the study of this anatomy, can be related to the auditory capacities of a given species. And we know that there is a correlation with the type of sounds we are able of perceiving and understanding and the type of sounds we usually produce. So in this sense, it's very interesting to know that the Encima de los Huesos hominins were particularly good and sensitive to the frequencies from 3 to 5 kHz, like modern humans, which is what is called the speech band that has a lot of perception for consonants. So at least, in a way, we know that almost 500,000 ago, this population has the machine to properly work to potentially develop a speech, like we have, articulated language. So this is also a very nice way, indirect way, to approach some things that unfortunately do not fossilize, because most of the things related with language indeed are becoming for muscles and soft tissues that they get degraded, that they don't fossilize, so we really have to work with the neck bone evidence. So as you see, we have many different types of bones that is giving us the opportunity of studying many different aspects about anatomy, about auditory capacities, maybe about speech, different adaptations, about disease, about different sufferers. But I think it's also very interesting that having such a variability allows us to study how was this population and to really dig into what it was called the process of Neanderthalization. And as I was showing you today, all these typical Neanderthal traits, all these things that make us easier to recognize Neanderthals that were very distinct. But thanks to having Encima de los Huesos, we can know that in a way, you know, it's like a receipt of cuisine. You know the ingredients, you know the features, you know how they should look like to really make the receipt. But it is very important not only to have the ingredients, but also to know in which moment each of those ingredients have to be added. So in a way, Encima has allowed us to have a master chef Neanderthal. So they don't just appear as it was like suddenly Neanderthals appear like they were as a whole. It was not. The Neanderthalization process was indeed a process that took hundreds of thousands of years, and we know that not all the anatomical parts became Neanderthal in one go. So in that sense, we know, particularly thanks to the Cima de los Huesos, that the evolution of the Neanderthal features was in mosaic. We know that the first parts to really show the Neanderthal character, all the Neanderthal flavor, were indeed the masticatory apparatus, the mandibles, the teeth, and the upper vault. You can see it here, as we will show you some examples, like the supraorbital torus, this mid-facial typical prognatism of Neanderthals, which is almost there in the case of the Cima de los Huesos. But they are less Neanderthal. It's something that is going to come later in this cuisine received, which is a more primitive brain cases and basic cranium. But also, Cima de los Huesos have some things that we think are unique to them. Unique to them until we find a population that also shows them, because we know that we are in a way in a bit of disadvantage because we have such a wide population and not always have the possibility to compare it with other isolated fossils from other sites. But they have some singularities that are related, for example, in the teeth. They have very small teeth, smaller than you usually find in a middle Pleistocene population and even Neanderthals, even like very similar or falling within the range of variation of current populations like us. And they have an unusual cranial height, as I will show you. So we have here the beautiful evidence, teeth and mandibles, that they are flourishing Neanderthal from very early, from the beginning. So 430,000 years ago, we already have a population that has what a Neanderthal has to have in their mouths. So we can see, for example, the mandibles. This is also a very beautiful example that we have the possibility of studying variability and even sexual dimorphisms. Sexual dimorphisms refers to the differences we are going to have in morphology, but also in size between the males and the females of a population. And we know, for example, that Cima de los Huesos has it very similar to modern humans' population, between a 10 or 15% larger males than females. But in this case, attending to the morphology, we have the typical Neanderthal mandible. The no chin, this recessing symphysis, the retromolar space, which we have seen in Cima de los Huesos that sometimes the size varies depending on the size of the mandible, this very wide ramus of the mandible, and this asymmetrical sigmoid notch, you know, that has a more posterior position that is talking about a quite a low condyle in the mandible. This is a very typical classic Neanderthal mandible. And then we also have the teeth, which are my favorite part, because they really show in such a very small space, you know, it's like diamonds. You don't really need a big thing. You have something with a lot of value in the very small size that is going to give you a lot of information. And Cima de los Huesos dentitions present all the morphological traits that either in the degree of expression, frequency, or in combination are usually considered as typical of Homo neanderthalensis. And then here I could really spend a lot of time talking because the surprise we have with this population, even 430,000 years ago, is that they are Neanderthal, sometimes even too Neanderthal, more Neanderthal even than other populations. That has to be with this process of variability and bottlenecking that is going to be occurring during the Middle Pleistocene. Here I could stop for long talking to you about the beauty of these jewelries, but they really have everything you expect to find in a Neanderthal, but you have the surprise to find it so early, so you can enjoy it so early in the fossil record. You're going to have, as Jack was mentioning, this continuous mid-trigonid crest. It's a very typical Neanderthal feature. That doesn't mean that it's exclusive to them, but this idea of really having it in high frequencies and very exaggerated is something that happens with Neanderthals. We have it also this very typical shape in the upper first molar, when you have this rhomboidal shape with this bulging hypocone in the distal lingual corner. We have this very round and convex upper central incisor, so they have like a shovel shape, which is a classic feature you can even find in actual populations and aboriginal populations and ancient populations, but in their own way. It's like when you have a car and you really do the tuning, you know, and you add your own style to the things, because in that way Neanderthals took, for example, the shovel shape, and they are their own style. They have this convexity that you are not going to find in the shovel shape you find usually, for example, in modern human populations. And it is a tooth that in a way grows so much in such a small place that felt forced to fold over itself and develop this sort of triangular shape that has been coined triangular shovel shape, that it is typical of Neanderthals, and we can also find in these Middle Pleistocene populations. We also have some other features probably you have heard before about, which is the taurodontism. Taurodontism is a feature that is considered very typical of Neanderthals. In the case of the Cima de los Huesos populations, we have it in different degrees. We have some cases that is not that pronounced. It refers like to the late bifurcation of the roots. Here you see that the roots are bifurcated, but it was quite late, so you have quite sort of enlarged pulp cavities. but sometimes it's so exaggerated that here, where you should be having the roots, don't never get to divide. So you really have this like a block and an enlarged pulp cavity inside. This is a feature that in the past was assessed only by external morphology. Now we can really, with the use of micro CT, really study inside and measure these volumes and see how they have changed. But this is some examples of the type of meso and hyperthyroidontitis you can find in the medial Pleistocene populations, and it has been described classically at the beginning in the very first dental studies that were performed as a typical Neanderthal feature. But in some things that we were saying, they are very Neanderthals, in other things, they are not. And one of them is in the mean capacities of the mean cranial capacities, which is about 1,232 cubic centimeters as a mean, which is well below the Neanderthal and the Pleistocene Homo sapiens mean that will reach about 1,500 centimeters, cubic centimeters. So we are talking about a population that is very Neanderthal, but still has a relatively quite small brain compared to later populations. So in that sense, in both the size, but also in the morphology of the posterior and basic cranium in general, let's say that the cranium itself is still primitive and not as typical as we're going to find in later Neanderthal populations. We're talking about some other unique things. Here I bring you an example. In this case, we have a surprisingly high cranial vault, where the maximum width, the parietal bosin, is quite high compared to what we should be expecting in the case of Neanderthals. So in a way, this height is more typical of Homo sapiens, but in the case of the cima de los huesos, it seems that this population also presents something that is a bit outside what would be typically found in Neanderthals, and is also different from some other primitive populations. In this way, it's not that we could consider this as a sapiens feature, but probably was inherited in an independent, was not inherited, but developed in an independent way. So we're talking about a population in the middle Pleistocene that in isolation has developed some features that in parallel are similar to the ones that maybe modern human populations have. And also happens with the teeth. I was mentioning you, the posterior teeth, molars, are very small. Are very small in their size, they have really type of mesiobuccal and distolingual diameters that really fall within the variation of modern human populations. This is something quite unique, talking about a population that lived 430,000 years ago, and even sometimes happens something that we thought was unique or even autapomorphic of our species, and it is not. That is not only about the size, but also in this reduction of the molars, they even lose main cusps. Usually our molars have 5 cusps, 1, 2, 3, 4, and should be a fifth here that is missing. And this 4 cusps molar is a very typical feature of modern populations. But we have to say that it's not exclusive, because Cima de los Huesos populations have shown us that this can be seen before. So this is what is interesting. We have a lot of fossils that are really telling us a lot of information about taxonomy, about the origin of Neanderthals, of how to build a Neanderthal, as Jean-Jacques said in a beautiful article in Science. In my case, I am more prosaic, I say how to cook a Neanderthal. But you know, we have amazing samples that are talking about variability, and we have to be proud and happy, because in this case, we're talking about 28 individuals, and we have been able of reconstructing up to 17 skulls of these 28 individuals. And that's something unique. That's something impressive that I have to say, indeed, that it's not that the skulls appear like this. Some of these skulls, of the 17 skulls I'm gonna show you, are made of little pieces that have been put together, and sometimes the distance is years, since one of them was found and the other can be like 10 years. So we're talking about delicate and dedicated work from the people working in this site that have been really getting the pieces of the puzzle to reconstruct the story. So you can really see that these skulls were really formed after many 20 years of excavation, work, and research. So fossils do not come like this. They really have to have a bit of work, you know, behind the scene before they can really be shown to the society. And thanks to that, finally, recently, was published this paper, which was about Neanderthal roots, the cranial and chronological evidence from Cima de los Huesos. And now you're going to have to allow me to stop here a little, because I think we are in a world that we tend to go fast, to not really stop to think and to admire and to observe. And I have to say that each of them is impressive, not only because of the information they give as a whole about the Neanderthal origins, but because each of them was a person with a story behind. And because if instead of 17, they were 12, I would say that we were having the most gorgeous Pirelli calendar, because the Atapuerca edition, that each of them would deserve 1 month and more, and we should really like stop to see these gorgeous beauties that we have from more than 430,000 years ago. And we could really go and enjoy, and we should, and I'm only going to pass as a honor and homage to the people who have been working in reconstructing them for all these years, that we could have maybe a January that is a bit more shy and is showing less of himself, but at least enough to see a bit of announcement of these Neanderthal features in the back. We can have a February that we are already showing more complete aspects of the vault that, as we said, was more primitive. We also have March that is already becoming even a bit more complete, and we have here this announcement of the orbital torus. Or we have, for example, April, is this April? Yeah. Where we also have an information, for example. I cannot give you details about all of them, but let's stop in some of them. In this case, with this beautiful cranium, we have a pathology. I'm showing you here in this close-up the other side, but it was easier to see. We have a pathology which means an hyperostosis of the auditory canal, which is bilateral, symmetrical, so we really have a circular, excessive growth of this tympanic lamina that is really like closing the auditory canal. So there has been a lot of work trying to investigate what is the etiology of this pathology. Some people say that could be related, this abnormal growth that has been closing the auditory canal could be related to a continuous exposure to cold water, which is something, you know, like a reaction of the bone in that part, which is very sensitive, would be producing this bilateral growth. And others have suggested that it is indeed an osteoma of the tympanic ring. In this case, we would be facing a case of a tumor, which is very unusual to find tumors in the past, a benign tumor. But despite it was benign, it would be implied that this hominin probably had this auditory canal quite closed, that is going to have recurrent infections, and probably he's going to have hearing problems. So we also have to wonder how was living in the middle Pleistocene if you were deaf. So apart from the pain and the difficulties and the infections that probably have because of the retention of the liquids. And then comes May, and this is spring, and this is flourishing, and this is beauty, and this you have one of the most amazing specimens you're going to have for the middle Pleistocene, which you have the opportunity to visit the real one face to face in the Museo de la Evolución Humana in Burgos, which is one of the unique museums that really have in permanent exhibition the original fossils. I know you're going to go there, it's not that clear. They are the original ones. All the fossils that are shown there are original, so don't miss the opportunity to go and see. This very special guy, one of the most complete hominins we have found for the middle Pleistocene, and that we were able even of associating the column, has been nicknamed as Miguelón, remembering our big Miguel Indurain that I'm sure that all of you know was for 5 years consecutive winner of the Tour de France. So also was in this euphoria of that year that the Skull 5 appeared, later has been completed, and he has the name because for them, you really, they become familiar to us and they really become like someone we know. So Miguelón has also a story behind, many stories indeed, but one particular and one interesting related with a pathology he has, which is probably one of the most severe pathologies we have discovered in this population. He has an osteitis of the maxilla. That means that has an inflammation of the bone in the left part of his face. So that's why this part is completely remodeled, deformed, because the bone has been inflamed. You have this porous and irregular aspect that is extending all the way up to the orbit, to the entrance and the base of the nose, and also inside the floor of the nose. The origin of this infection was probably because of a broken tooth. So probably this hominin received an impact that broke the tooth, left exposed, as I was telling you, the pulp cavity, and didn't die of this, and we know that we didn't die, because if you study the borders of the fracture, you see that they are already polished. So it means that he kept using the teeth in life. It was just a fracture that you do after life, you really have these very much more sharp edges. In this case, it is polished, so it means that this tooth was used like this and broken. So because of that, he probably developed a local infection that really even have its phlegmon, its abscess, a drainage canal to the exterior. that we can reconstruct thanks to the CT scan. So there was an inflammation, an abscess that was draining pus. So probably this individual, not only is interesting to think that he really have a deformity of his face because he has really all this inflammation, but really has pain. But what it is more important, when we study the extension of this lesion, we see that it's very severe. And here you see, this is the nasal aperture, this is the right side and the left. And you see the asymmetry. You see how thick and how inflamed and how altered is this part of the bone. And it goes all the way also to the nasal part. And this part is very dangerous because indeed it's a particular area that has been named the danger triangle of the face. And it's a region that indeed all the nasal floor has a very particular intense irrigation of vessels, blood vessels that go directly to the brain. So as I was telling you, at that time, an infection in this danger triangle of the face that was left to evolution without nothing that could stop it in such a degree and severity because has really remodelated in an intensive way the whole part of the face could be likely a cause of death in such a way that a local infection became a general infection and could have died of septicemia. But we don't know. This is an hypothesis because unfortunately it's very difficult to really find causes of death in the individuals because once they die, they don't really have and leave any more mark of it. As I was saying, indeed, it's a good thing to have scars, to have all these things because it means that you survived to them. So you were alive and passed all these difficulties. And then we can keep going in these months. I don't know in which month we are now, but it could be a spring too because it's beauty, it's flourishing. So it's cranium 6, cranium 7, cranium 8, cranium 9, cranium 10. As you see, in all of them, we can really see the variability of all those features that Jean-Jacques was talking about. We see how we have this more typical Neanderthal funnel shape and prognathines, the mediofacial prognathines you find in Neanderthals. Cranium 11. And, you know, here we also have something else. This is a pre-adolescent individual that if you look in a close-up, it really have a big impact, a blunt trauma probably in the eye, but okay, probably he was not very nice, he really had a lot of pain because it's really an extensive remodelation, but this lesion was healing. Obviously he died, but we don't know about this, but this healing, this porous surface of the bone means that despite it was very big, he survived to this injury. But also we know, and can imagine at that time, that probably, because it was affecting to all the soft tissues, probably had problems in vision and quite a lot of pain. And we have cranium 12, and we have cranium 13, and we have cranium 14, and here again, we have to stop. And we have to stop because I think I would say, this is curious, we were talking about Neanderthal features and you're stopping in one that, look at this forehead. It's much more vertical than the one we have. And what is the supraorbital torus, or this funny shape of this head? What is this skull doing in the whole assemblage? And that's the thing, this poor little girl have a deformation of the skull. So indeed, this shape is obeying up to a pathology that is very difficult to even, or is, we say is uncommon in current times. So to have found a case of a plagiocephaly in the case of the middle Pleistocene is quite of a unique situation. So as you know, when we are children until we become adults, all our skulls keep growing to allow the brain inside to grow too. In the case of this girl that we nickname as Benjamina, as a little girl, one of the sutures of the skull got a early or premature closure, meaning that that part of the brain could not really expand or grow in a normal way, so only the other ones were growing in an irregular, asymmetrical manner. This plagiocephaly, or also called craniosynostosis, synostosis closure, in this case an early closure, before time asymmetrical one, only from one side, that's why the brain, the skull keeps growing in an irregular fashion, had a lot of implications, not only about aesthetic, which we don't know to what extent was important in the past to really have someone whose appearance was not normal, because not all groups accept the rare one or weird one in the group. But in this case also implies that because this part was not really growing properly, the brain inside was also having some problems to develop normally. So we can infer that there was a little girl that at least survived until the age of 12 or something like that approximately, that was having probably some disabilities, mental disabilities. So we are talking about a population that it somehow was taking care of children with disabilities. So a learning well that make it quite late, I would say, for having probably some retardations and some problems to cope with the normality of the group. So these are important cases because indeed pathologies, which are supposedly a bad thing, are going to bring us the nice stories about the humankind. And in this case, we have a beautiful story. And then we have cranium 15, and we have cranium 16, and we have cranium 17. And here we have to stop again. And not only because it's the last month of our year, so far, our 17th month year, with a lot of bonus for the Pleistocene, but this guy has something here. You see these two holes, and these two holes are not just an old fracture that happened after the bone was moving or because you find them broken and you still did not find this little piece. That is what you could think. No. This guy has these two subrectangular fractures in this part, just in the forehead, above the left eye, which we have made a very close study, and they have been done, these fractures, these holes, in what we call perimortem. Perimortem means that it is around, very close to the moment of death. Could be just immediately or just after the moment of death. But we know that at least happened around the moment of death because this type of smooth and delamination of the edges of the fracture means that was done when the bone was still fresh and when probably there were like soft tissues attached to it. So the way it really breaks a bone when it's still with a lot of muscles and still with the grease and the periostin around in long bones, for example, is completely different than when we are really breaking a very old neck, dry bone. So in that case, we really know that this is something that happened very close to the death of the individual. And they have made a study really like SCI, you know, it's really criminal investigation. And they have seen that they have been made with probably the same object. So they have almost identical shape, and they can even only see that they differ slightly in the trajectory of the impact. So according to our colleagues in the Atapuerca team, they think that there are different alternatives we could be studying about what happened to this guy. Some of them could be that it really failed and really have a blow, but then in this case would be the unlikely possibility that it's really having with the same object, with the same shape, really two impacts in the same spot. Or, as they suggest, this could be one of the earliest cases of lethal interpersonal violence. So in this case, we'll be having a guy that has been really injured and insisted, like in the same spot, directly, because it's the same object, the same shape, and in almost in the same region, with the intention, we think, to kill. So in this case, this guy, as far as I know, does not have a name, but I would suggest that at least we could call him maybe Abel, because we don't know who made this to him, but we cannot discard yet there was another one from the group who really did this to him, but someone really tried to kill. So as I was showing you here today, there are many things. There is time for love, time for hate, but there's also time for elevated. And I don't want to leave you with this sour flavor of the poor Abel from Cima de los Huesos. And I'm going to bring you something else. Why are these hominins all buried here? One of the most definite hypotheses at this moment to explain the accumulation of Cima de los Huesos hominins is that it was indeed an intentional accumulation of the bodies. So these bodies are there because other hominins from the group brought them there. We have reached this conclusion after really ruling out many other aspects. We don't think that all these hominins were really like trapped there because there was a collapse of the cave, because the study of the geology of that cave is really discarding this possibility of really a collapse. At the same time, we don't find any stone tool, only one little exception or big exception, I would say, that I'm going to show you later. But if you really catch a population in that moment, you expect that it would be carrying something, which is not the case. They have also made the study of the type of the deposits, probably that accumulation is in situ. So there is a bit of low energy sediment, so it's not really that the bodies were like moved, probably they are almost in the place where they felt. The access to the Cima de los Huesos at the time the Cima de los Huesos hominins lived, was the only access to that chamber was indeed a vertical conduit. So it's not an easy way to access, and there was only this vertical conduit that was, in our opinion, the place that was used to redispose of the bodies that were dying. We have also made a taphonomical study. We could say, okay, maybe these bodies are here because they were the prey of a carnivore. But in all these more than 6,500 fossils, we have not really found any, or barely any mark of any carnivores. The only animals that we really consistently find together with the hominins from Cima de los Huesos are indeed these cave bears, Ursus dolinensis, which indeed these cave bears use the caves to hibernate. So along all these hundreds of thousands of years, sometimes they die and they fall there, but rarely we don't really have any other animal remain. And to this very unique accumulation and circumstances, we have to add, I was saying, not any stone tool, it's not true. Only one, Excalibur. This beautiful handex, which is made of a reddish, light brown quartzite, which is a raw material that is very uncommon in the context of the raw material that the populations in the Middle Pleistocene in Sierra de Atapuerca were employing, because we don't have stone tools here, but we have a site that is called Galeria, where we have quite of a nice variety of stone tools used by the populations of that time. And this raw material is not very common in the area, so we're talking about something that was really kept with them. It's the only one, it's quite exceptional in shape from an aesthetic point of view too, and has no traces of have been used. So we suggest that maybe in this case what we are having indeed is a sort of offer or tribute of the group to those that die. We still have to understand what were the cause of death. As I was saying, it's very difficult to identify the cause of death of the group, but it's also quite intriguing to know that we are having supposedly the healthiest or stronger individuals of the group. So maybe we could think of a battle or a sort of catastrophic event that affected that population, but maybe that population was really buried there and in the cima de los huesos, and this was offered as a sort of ritual. In that case, we would be having the earliest evidence in the humankind of an intentional burial. Although we are also open and very intriguing to explore, as you may have heard recently, this new species, Homo naledi, that has been also proposed as a possible intentional accumulation. And Tinar would say that this is one of the best studied and demonstrated cases of a burial in the humankind. And I could also finish here, and I say, I think I have shown you more than many and 17 reasons to come to Burgos to visit these sites. But I would say that even despite we're talking about science, also in science we have miracles. And in the last of these miracles was indeed the possibility of extracting and analyzing DNA from a population that is 430,000 years ago. So in that sense, we have to say that before this miracle, the earliest we could get was like DNA from Neanderthals, so no more than 40, 60,000 years, and that was something quite incredible indeed. But in this case, with Cima de los Huesos, we were able from this femur to extract DNA. It was a very nice work collaboration of our colleagues, also with the Max Planck, and I really think this is a sort of miracle. This is that type of thing that you would say, well, you would like to ask, knowing that it's not going to never happen. It happened, so never lose hope and keep wishing things. In this case, we really were able of having the mitochondrial genome sequence of a hominin from Cima de los Huesos. And if it was not already something amazing, we have a surprise. So this population that really is so Neanderthal, or so Neanderthal-like in some aspects, appears to have a very close relationship with Denisovans, not with Neanderthals. And who are the Denisovans? This, I would say, ghost species that has been defined indeed by the genetic sequence. Denisovans are a population that lived so far in the Denisova cave in Siberia. So how can it be that our population that live in the westernmost part of Eurasia has really genetic links or a type of kinship with someone who lived 38 to 40,000 years ago? Here we're talking about 400,000 years ago. How can it be? The Denisova sequence has been discovered as very primitive. It's a lineage that has origin about 1 million years ago. So this really put us a very intriguing puzzle of what and how could be the link between these two populations. We could really spend a lot of time. Jean-Jacques knows a lot about these possibilities and the genetics. From the possibilities that have been posed on the table, my favorite two ones are that this common genetic sequence that these far Denisovans and far west, far east populations have is because they have inherited from the same mother. So at a certain point, long time ago, maybe in the Near East, we have a source or a mother population that gave rise to a dispersal towards the west and a dispersal towards the east. And these two populations are going to be carrying the mitochondrial sequence inherited from that mother. But then they really follow the very separate and distant story. Another alternative that has been suggested is that the Cima de los Huesos hominins have this very old sequence that has like 1 million years old of antiquity because it has interbred or mixed indeed with a primitive hominin that may have survived late into the Middle Pleistocene and allowed them to meet. So indeed is what they call the introgression, that you put inside your genes a sequence that indeed belongs to another species in the past, an ancestral lineage. And we wondered, do we have this possibility? Who could be this population 1 million years old that passed this special Denisova sequence to the hominins proximal. Do we have it? Yes, we have it. And we have it also in the Sierra de Atapuerca, because there is another one, believe me, treasure trove there, which is related with Homo antecessor, one of the earliest hominins found in Europe, with claws around 1 million years old. It is the earliest hominin that has been found in Europe, together with Sima de la Elefante mandible. It's also found in Atapuerca, and this could be a quite of a special relationship. This hominin has been proposed as the last common ancestor of Neanderthals and modern humans. We still think that it's close around there, but we really have to keep investigating. But as I would say, this is a story that belongs together with the Sima del Elefante to the early Pleistocene, so I think this should be a story for another day. So thank you, George.